The Internet. The Final Frontier.
Well, hello. This week we're rejoined by Sean from VNS Reviews. He'll help us discuss vinyl records. I'll give you my top five favorite album covers. And Colin will clue us in to some of the most underappreciated films ever. I'm Justin Eisenstadt.
And I'm Colin Kakamas.
And you just got to the good part. Strap in and sit tight, because we are boldly going nowhere. Everybody, it's Friday, June 24th, and we're back again with another delightful episode of Boldly Going Nowhere.
Holy shit!
As always, I'm Justin Eisenstadt.
And I'm Colin Kakamas.
And with us, a special guest, though not quite as special because it's the second time around.
It is part deux.
Part deux for Sean Holmes from...
Part deux.
BNS Reviews.
Yeah, let's be French about it.
Yeah.
Which I hope you all went and checked out after last week's episode.
Well, hopefully. We plugged it like hell.
Yeah, I'm not going to... I'm not going to get on your cases about it, but seriously, you know, check it out.
But I will.
That's Sean's job.
Well, yeah, obviously, you got to whore yourself out one way or another.
You want to have a good time?
I like to think of it as aggressive self-promotion.
There you go.
Yes.
Which in this day and age... Assertive self-promotion. Which in this day and age is important for everyone to practice.
Indeed.
So, let's get started. But first... There's been something that's, you know, been eating at my craw. It's stuck in my craw. Actually,
oh, okay. I was gonna say eating
at your craw.
Well, I ate it, and now it's stuck in the craw.
Is it crab formed?
You know, I've actually never really understood that expression. I don't know what the craw is. I don't know how things get stuck in it.
Craw
sounds like someone's been reading a little bit of Homestar Runner.
Well, my point is, there's something that I'm slightly annoyed about.
Slightly miffed.
Miffed, perturbed.
Plus, whatever you want to call it.
And that's hacker culture.
Uh-oh.
I can type in the stuff and the screen pops up.
Now, for those who don't know, and that's probably very few people, because I bring this up constantly. I don't know why, but I constantly bring up the fact that I used to be a computer science major. I was for, you know, my first years of college. So it was a significant part of my life that I, you know, thought I was going to be part of this culture. And I had a lot of classes with people that would probably consider themselves, would term themselves as hackers. Now, why am I bringing up this now? Hacking and hackers and hacker culture has been in the news a lot recently, especially after the big, you know, issue with Sony and the PlayStation Network. But they've also been targeting a lot of other, you know, sites, some high profile, some not as much. I actually got an email just the other day from BioWare telling me that the BioWare forums had been hacked.
Oh, wow.
Oh, geez.
And my first reaction was, wait, I'm a member of the BioWare forums?
I didn't know you were.
Neither did I.
I didn't either. Probably because I used to play Neverwinter Nights a lot back in
Jesus Christ.
High school, whenever that game came out. That was... talking a long time ago, so
it must have been a while ago. Yeah.
So I was not particularly concerned about it, although it's always an issue, you know, when you get hacked, even if it's on a tiny little site, because a lot of people, you know, use the same passwords for multiple sites. So even if they hack, like, you know, some little forum, they can try that password, and they're much closer to hacking other important sites.
Yeah, and it's definitely, you can tell a lot of those people were, like, raised on that, you know, that crap they fed us in the 80s and the 90s. It's like, yo, you can hack your way into a better life. Ugh.
He's hacking the net, dude.
We're gonna go to the White House.
Now, I read an article earlier this week. It was on the internet. I forget what site. I know that's great journalism right there. Point is, it was sort of this open call, this open letter from these two big hacker groups, Anonymous and, I think, Lulzsec is the other one. L-U-L-Z-S-E-C. Lulzsec.
Lulzsec.
And basically, they were imploring all hackers, wannabe hackers, and hacker enthusiasts, I guess, to wage all-out open warfare, basically, on high-traffic, high-profile government websites. Like, important shit.
Yeah, that seems like a good idea.
And this is where I and many other people are like, alright, it's time to draw the line. Clearly, I mean, we've had to draw the line many times and keep scribbling over it and draw new lines. I mean, it's not a threat that's easy to contain. But here's my issue, the one that I want to bring up in particular about hacking. The whole idea that hackers are like, oh, we're doing a public service. You know, we're showing the flaws in your security system. We're exposing these weaknesses so that you can fix them. Well, to me, that is like going into a bank and holding up the place and killing all the security guards and not taking any money, but going, hey, everybody, we just did you all a favor. Your security's weak. You need to step up your game a bit. Let's ignore the fact that you just killed, you know, knocked off a dozen, you know, security guards just to prove a point. This is dumb because... Yes, maybe the loopholes were the flaws were there, but the only people who seemed concerned with breaking them were you, the hackers.
You know, the people who exploit those kind of loopholes.
It's kind of a chicken and the egg thing because they're like, well, we've exposed these weaknesses, we've exposed these security holes, but no one would know about the security holes in the first place, including the criminals, unless you exposed them.
Yeah,
right.
And you're still costing tremendous amounts of money to these companies.
I think what it is, yeah. This has been publicized a lot. A lot of hackers that got caught like early on, like in the 90s, like you heard about this, they got caught like ripping off billions from like some private bank. Not only did the government not prosecute them, but actually hired them as consultants, quote unquote, to monitor, quote unquote, their activities. So do you think they're possibly just doing that to see if they can get a fat government paycheck and never be hassled about anything ever again?
That's what they all think. They all think, oh, if I hack into, you know, the CIA, the CIA is going to be really impressed and offer me a job as a high level analyst.
So let me get this straight. They hire these people to hack into the mainframe, their own shit, essentially. Pardon my French.
No. No, it's they hire them after. I mean, basically, what happens is they caught them committing crimes, right?
Right.
But they also acknowledge the fact that the flaws were so great in the security systems that they were like, okay, here's the deal: we will not press charges. We'll actually bring you on as consultants, so that you can point out other flaws in other security systems, and we'll pay you to do that. But also, you are now going to be monitored by us at all times.
Here's the thing. Here's the flaw with the, you know, people in anonymous.
Sounds like a scare tactic.
Right. Here's the thing that they don't realize.
It's a very good possibility.
I actually have a friend who does this. He works, you know, his major is cybersecurity. He actually is employed by a cybersecurity firm to do this exact thing, to try and hack into sites and expose their weaknesses. Difference is, they know he's doing it. They've given him permission to do it. If you just go willy-nilly and hack into a site and be like, hey, look what I did, they're not going to give you a job. They're going to put you in prison. The thing is, the FBI, the CIA, NSA, they go out and find people first and say, hey, we want you to test out our security system. Here are the provisions. Here are the boundaries of what you can and can't do. Go to town as long as you don't, you know, as long as you sign these non-disclosure agreements, all this stuff, don't, you know, release any sensitive information. This is not what we're talking about. The people, the hackers of Anonymous, Lulzsec, all these people, they want to rip open these security sites, expose all this classified, you know, government information, WikiLeaks, all that stuff, just to say they did it for some sort of nebulous ethical principle that I don't think any of them really have a clear grasp of.
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
And it leads me to the larger point here, which is that there's this sense of entitlement and this attitude of our generation that just because you can do something, like if you can do something, you should.
Yeah, in most cases, that really doesn't lead to positive results.
Right, and that's why I quit. You know, that's why I quit pirating music. You know, I used to, you know, I pirated a lot of music back in high school, and then I just realized. It's kind of childish. Like, it's just an immature thing to do. Like, yes, you can. It's very easy to do it. Does that mean you should? No. Music is important to me. I want to pay money for it. Even if, you know, I'm not going to get into the whole bullshit about, oh, well, you know, where's that money going to? Well, the point is, music costs money. it sucks, but that's the way it is. And also, just out of principle, I'm not entitled to free music. No one is entitled to free music. And
yeah, really, the only people who can say you can have free music are the fucking musicians who make the music.
Yeah.
Say, if they say, hey, here's some free music, enjoy, then okay, maybe you're entitled to free music. If they say, hey, it's free. But just because they make other music that you just don't want to pay for, it doesn't necessarily mean you're fucking entitled.
The only person who gets to decide if a product is free is the person who is offering the product. You don't get to decide for yourself if something is free. You don't go up into a grocery store and be like, yo, man, these chips should be open source. I'm just going to take them. Down with fascists, man. I'm taking these chips. I know I've been just on a roll with terrible analogies here, because
one's invisible and the other one's visible.
And yes, hacking into the PlayStation Network is not the same as going to a bank and actually killing people. My point is, these guys need to get their heads examined.
Need to pull their heads out of their asses, because even though they say they're doing a public service, they're not doing it on behalf of a monitoring body, like, you know, a law enforcement agency. They're doing it to do it,
right?
And they're breaking the law. There's a difference.
And I'll just sum. Unless either of you guys had any more thoughts on this,
I had a little bit. And frankly, it's a scare tactic, and a scare tactic is a form of terrorism. That is what terrorism is to put fear and use that fear to manipulate the other people into what you want them to do.
That is the definition.
That is a basic definition of terrorism. I think is like, I don't want to be like willy-nilly like all Fox News here, but terrorists, but it really is. It's terrorism. You can label these hackers as terrorists, and that these companies are paying, or these consultants are paying a certain number for these people that go out. It's just ridiculous.
So I'm just going to sum this up by saying that the reason I just like abandoned computer science, had wanted nothing to do with it anymore, is not because I wasn't good at it. It's not because I couldn't cut it in my classes. It's because I was tired of dealing with people like this. I was tired of dealing with arrogant, antisocial dicks who felt who just did not see a bigger picture, had no concern for anyone else but themselves. And if it sounds like I'm unfairly stereotyping, just remember, I can easily name actual people who fit these descriptions.
Not that you would, but you
could. Not that I would, but I know actual people. I'm not just generalizing here. I know actual people who fit these descriptions.
I know a few of those people too, and it's sort of like, well, they're most of them are antisocial, and even though they go through these social networking sites and hack those too, because let's face it, Facebook is really easy to hack.
Yeah,
it's pretty
sad,
simple.
But hey,
and this technology is progressing forward so fast, and it's really hard to keep up with it. So there's another reason why you shouldn't really be in it unless you want. You're always on to the next thing.
Remember, you got to be in it to win it.
Yeah.
I realize I just got up on a soapbox the last 10 minutes, and I'm probably going to get hacked by a shit ton of people. I don't really care because I don't really have anything, you know, valuable or anything worth
hiding. Well, whatever you
hiding.
Put up on Facebook is theirs.
But let's get on with the show, boys. Let's talk about some, you know, uplifting positive things like music.
All right.
Oh, yay.
So this week, I think our topic of discussion is going to be vinyl records, because we're fucking hipsters.
Well, maybe you are.
I have never heard of that.
Yeah, maybe you are.
I bought, you know, a bunch of new records this week, so I thought, hey, this week is as good as a week as any to talk about vinyl. Now, I could go on at great lengths on vinyl, because I wrote, you know, a 30-page, you know, independent research paper about vinyl records. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to get all technical on you guys. But there are a couple, you know, key points about vinyl. There's a lot of reasons people collect vinyl. And most of them have to do with sound quality. You know, people think that vinyl sounds better.
It does.
I'm actually going to personally say I don't necessarily buy into that. I don't consider myself an audiophile, which may come as a surprise to a lot of people, but I don't think I can actually tell the difference. Like, I'm not one of those people who could, like, listen to, you know, an MP3 and tell you what bit rate it was sampled at. Like,
well, you can hear a difference. It's little puffs. It's little puffs that you have on the disc. Joking aside, there's there's a little bit of what you get. It's, it sounds organic. You really have to listen to them for a while to actually gain and the difference between the two.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of factors, too. It depends on what kind of player you're using, your sound system, the acoustics of the room. There's a lot of different factors that go into how something sounds.
That's true, but then and also in regards to at least the vinyl aspect, you also have to take into account how old is the record player you're using. Is it, like, pre-1980s?
Right.
Because it's going to run on a different voltage setting. The record itself, is the disc in good condition? Is it humid outside? All those things are going to affect the overall quality of the vinyl, because vinyl is not a...
Say if you have like a room temperature, soundproof room.
If you have a hermetically sealed room.
If you have a room built for it, it'll sound amazing.
Yes, but most don't.
But most don't. Most are like, well, record player? What's that? Oh, it sounds like crap.
Right, I mean, the instant you take a record out of its sleeve, it starts gathering dust immediately. So, sound quality is not the reason I collect vinyl. Let me tell you the reasons I do collect vinyl.
Why do you collect vinyl?
One is just the physicality of it. It's something you can hold, something you can touch and look at, and it takes up space. It is a physical object.
You're not sleeping with it, are you, Ray?
That would take vinyl fetishes to a whole new level.
Well, only 35s.
Wow.
The other reason is the sort of the connection to the past. It's the fact that I can find old music that I would have a lot harder time finding on CD. And sure, I could find them easily by downloading them, but I can actually find these old records that somebody else has owned. Somebody else has enjoyed these. These have a story to tell because they've been around for decades.
And not only that, but I guarantee you, walk into a normal retail chain these days, Best Buy, Target, Walmart, doesn't matter. Walk into any of those, pick out a CD, complete the transaction, boom, you're done. Walk into a record store, you can easily get into a 45-minute conversation over anything you find. Like, the record guy will be flipping through your transactions, and he'll be like, oh man, this record, you ever heard this, this, and this, and this? And then there's your conversation.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because one of the things I found doing this research project is that a lot of record stores are actually not like that. It's what I was expecting. It's what you think of. You know, you expect to walk into a store and see a lot of people conversing, and like High Fidelity, you expect to see the store clerks having crazy conversations. Most of the stores I've been to, it's often pretty quiet and honestly kind of antisocial.
Well, let me ask you a question, though. What chains did you look at what stores did you go into?
A lot of local stores around Baltimore. My favorite, personally, is called Tracks on Wax. It's in Catonsville. It was the main site for my research project, and it's my favorite store because they only sell LPs. That's all they sell, exclusively vinyl LPs.
Nice.
Now the owner of the owners and the employees of that store are super friendly. Mm-hmm. But I've been to other record stores, like Truvine in Hamden. I went in there one day, Lena and I, you know, were like, oh, let's check out, you know, some hipster guy was like, that she worked with at the theater, was like, you should check out Truvine, it's the best record store I've been to. Now, we go in there, and it's really small, and the guy doesn't even acknowledge us, doesn't look up from his computer to even acknowledge our existence, and he is playing just the weirdest music, like, just completely unsettling, uncomfortable, weird ass shit.
He finds his consonants in dissonance. Mm.
I think he was trying to drive us away, honestly. And I know I would consider myself pretty knowledgeable about music. It took me 5 minutes before I found a single record from a band that I'd ever heard of. 5 minutes before I found, and I was going through stacks, and I couldn't find a single artist that I'd ever even heard of.
You know what that reminds me of? R. Stevens, Diesel Sweeties, Indie Rock Pete.
Mm-hmm.
Just his only existence is just to, yes, like, point out shit that you don't know.
This guy,
and like shit
this
you don't
guy
know.
Was the physical embodiment of
a hipster.
He
is the
of
the,
indie rock Pete.
Yeah,
because he was unfriendly. He wanted nothing to do with us. All he wanted was us to get out of his store so he could go back to whatever the hell he's doing. And my question is, how the hell do you stay in business with a model like that?
Some people enjoy the tart. Some people are gluttons for punishment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
so
just the way it is, man.
I finally found one rack where, like, ooh, here's some cool stuff. Like, and Lena was just like, let's go. I can't take this anymore. Let's get out of here. But then there are other places, like, the like Soundgarden, which is over in Fells Point, which is probably the best music store I've ever been to. In fact, it's actually rated one of the best music stores in the country.
Because they actually like business.
Yeah, it's a huge store, but I mean,
one would only think
they're like, you know, they're like take CD Game Exchange in Frederick and
yes,
blow it up by like 10 times because yeah, they do, you know, vinyl, CDs, video games, all that stuff.
Okay,
so. But Tracks on Wax is one of the few stores I've been to that only sells vinyl, only sells LPs, because that's another difference, too. They don't sell 45s, they don't sell, you know.
The big,
Yeah?
The LPs.
LP is a 12-inch.
Okay.
Yep, 45, 33 and a third RPM. 45s are 7-inch, generally like singles or
albums, basically.
Or small ones. Yeah, albums, which is what I'm talking about here.
Yeah.
But most of the time, it's people sort of, you know, you can have two guys rubbing elbows looking through the stacks, and they won't exchange a single word to each other. Now, I think that back in the day, record stores were a haven for people to go and talk about shit. That stuff's all online now. The actual social aspect of record collecting is now online, which
that's kind of sad.
It is. It's really sad, because you can go into a store expecting to have great conversations, and it's like pulling teeth with most people. They a lot of times they just have their headphones on now.
So. Yeah, but I mean that's a whole other conversation. The difference between
So the third reason is album art. That
yes
is probably the biggest factor for me actually.
Yeah, this the collectability, like you're saying, the tangible feeling of having that record. I mean, CDs kind of like it's a little smaller, but if you have like this big box. Poster, that's art.
It is art. There are some fantastic works of art that have often been overlooked because they were on pop music and not, you know, hanging on a gallery somewhere. But there are some, I mean, really, really talented professional artists back in the day working on album art. You know, people like Roger Dean, who made all the album covers for Yes, other progressive rock bands like that.
I love the Yes album covers. Those are awesome. Mm-hmm.
Hypnosis, who was their own design studio, who did all the Pink Floyd album
yes
covers. Very famous.
Yeah, classic.
Storm.
Posters are still on the shelves at
Hot Topic, Spencer's. I mean, basically, yeah. I mean, generations of trendy indie clothes shops will
the
be
one
making.
With, the one with the girls, and they each had the different album cover on
yeah
them.
Yeah, I
and
love that's probably
well,
the best poster I've
in
ever
fact,
seen. Yeah.
In fact, this is a great segue into my top five for this week. Normally, I save the top five till the end of the segment, but since we're sort of already on the subject of album art, I'm going to go ahead and do our top five for this week.
Hey, top five songs about death. Allura's Dad Tribute List.
All right, so before I get into my actual top five, I would be remiss if I didn't, you know, pay homage to the sort of the two gold standards of album covers. You know, probably the two greatest album covers of all time. One, Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon.
Yes.
And two, the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. I mean, there's not that much that needs to be said about these album covers because everyone knows these, particularly Dark Side of the Moon. That icon is, I mean, it is what I said. It's an icon. It's iconic. And so I wouldn't put those on my top five list simply because I think everyone knows about them. I would like to say, you know, talk about some that might be a little more obscure. Not really. They're still pretty well-known covers. So, at number five, I see you guys having some technical difficulties over here.
Now we're good.
The battery, you know, it doesn't work too well, meaning it doesn't work at all.
All right.
Unless you have direct power plugged into it.
Then it just...
Oh, Mac.
McFly, hoverboards don't work on water.
Unless you have
got
power.
Yes, my hoverboard has...
I think your girlfriend will love you for that.
Yeah.
Well, yes, although she'll probably complain that I, like, can't do that impression at all, but...
Eh, whatever.
So, continue on Pink Floyd.
So my actual top five. Number five, I'm going to say Houses of the Holy by Led Zeppelin.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Creepy, glowing, white alien children climbing up weird rocks.
Funny story. There was an article, I don't know if it was on Cracked or was another, I think it was on MSN a few weeks ago. They actually were doing the follow-up with kids on album covers. they actually interviewed the kid from the Houses of the Holy album.
Really?
Yeah. Apparently he's doing quite well.
That's good. That actually reminds me of another one, the Naked Baby, Nevermind.
Yeah, also in that list.
That kid's done, like,
did
interviews,
you know,
and stuff.
He's, like, 20-something now?
Yep.
Did you know that it's been 20 years since the release of Smell Like Teen Spirit?
God, that makes me feel really old.
20 years.
It'll do that to you.
That means we were, like, what, 4 or 5 when that shit came out? Jesus.
Yeah, like, so like some of the other albums, bands on this list, it's hard to pick one in particular, because I was tied between Houses of the Holy and Zeppelin 4, but really every Zeppelin album has pretty great album
art. But you had to go with Houses of the
but
Holy.
But I got to give it to Houses of the Holy.
Yeah, I'll give it
over
that.
Zep 4. Just,
I'll give you that.
That image is pretty remarkable. Number 4 actually is a tie, because I would say, I actually think they're pretty similar pieces of artwork. But number 4 is a tie between Abraxas by Santana and Bitches Brew by Miles Davis.
Ooh. Yeah, I see that.
I'm not even that big a fan of Santana, you know, the music. I think Santana's okay. It's not one of my favorite bands, but I think that album cover is amazing. And I should mention,
strictly off music, it would have to be Miles Davis.
Yeah, definitely. But I want to mention that every single album cover I mention here, I'm going to put up on the Podomatic website. So people actually have a reason to look at the Podomatic page this time instead of just playing it off of Facebook, which is what I assume most people do.
Woohoo! Yay.
Not that I'm upset. As long as you guys listen, that's cool.
Because most of our views at the BS Reviews podcast are just feed views.
Yeah, exactly.
There's like barely any downloads.
Yeah. Very few downloads, very few page views. But again, that's boring logistical talk.
Yes,
but both Abraxas and Bitches Brew they're similar in that they both have naked African women on them, you know. But also just the use of sort of swirling colors and, you know, abstract art makes both of these covers, in my mind, very striking. And also, great music. I mean, Bitches Brew is an amazing album.
It's Miles Davis. I mean, you can't go wrong with Miles Davis.
It was sort of a turning point. In fact, both two of the albums on this list are albums that I would credit with actually starting an entire genre of music. This, I would say, Bitches Brew sort of created the genre of jazz fusion. Which
I can go with that.
We could talk about for another day. At number 3, I'm going to say Relayer by Yes. Again, I could choose pretty much any album cover by Yes for this spot.
Yeah, pretty much.
But Relayer's probably the best.
Very Tolkien-inspired.
Yeah. Now, Roger Dean, I love his artwork. He's best known for his work with Yes, but he's also done a lot of other bands. He's done covers for bands like Gentle Giant. He has actually done a Pink Floyd cover himself.
Really? Which one did he do?
It was like a cover of some live album or some like best of album, not like an actual studio album.
Ah.
But he's done a lot of work, but his work is very distinctive. It has a very unique pattern, particularly with the Yes album covers. He creates all these weird, like, natural structures, like rock formations and landscapes, but that landscapes that don't exist on this planet or, you know, any planet that we know of. But so he creates these alien worlds, but they're all still they're scenes from nature, and it's really cool. At number 2, Brain Salad Surgery by Emerson, Lake and Palmer. Now, this album art is awesome for two reasons. One is created by H.R. Giger, who, if you're not familiar with him, Aliens.
See Aliens.
The movie Alien, he designed the aliens. He designed the creatures, all the artwork for the aliens.
Really?
Alien and the first two movies.
Even the Hunger Faces.
Everything.
Awesome.
And he, again, has a very distinctive style. It all is this weird, very creepy, very dark, and very kind of unsettling imagery, particularly on Brain Salad Surgery, which is famous for having what appears to be a picture of, well, a cock going into a woman's mouth. but it's very subtle. Like, you have to really look close to actually make that out. Like I said, I'll put all the album covers up
very
so
Freudian.
You can look at them yourself.
Very Freudian.
I can't, I'm not going to, you know, I can't mention Fellatio and not give you something to look at. But the Brain Salad Surgery...
Nice of you.
One of, like, sort of the theories about that name is that Brain Salad Surgery is a slang term for head, you know.
Really?
Yeah. That's
brain
one of the
theories.
Brain Salad
Surgery is a euphemism for oral sex?
Yeah, I didn't make that up. That's sort of
I don't know, man. Part
of
me is thinking you did.
I really didn't. I really didn't.
Okay.
If I did, that would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
I wish I could
brain
take credit
salad
for that
surgery.
Theory.
Guess you learn something every day.
Yeah, I know, right?
Right. But again, that's theory. Like, it's not like the members of the band ever came out and said that. That's just people's theories. You know, people love to come up with these theories about artwork, about bands. About,
right.
And
okay.
I actually want to do another an episode sometime in the future. It'll be about sort of secrets or weird things that people have hidden in music. Like, you know, backmasking or, you know, things like that. Or hidden tracks, things like that.
Okay. Or, yeah, right. Paul is dead.
Yeah, exactly. I was gonna say. So... The other cool thing about this album is the actual physical packaging. One of the cool things about vinyl records that separates them CDs is not just the art, but the packaging itself, because they can do things, unlike a CD, where you might have one that kind of opens up in a case, or maybe it's in a little sleeve, that's about it. With vinyl records, there's a lot of different options. They can have, you know, gatefold, where it opens up. You can have just a regular sleeve. You can have, like, flaps that open up. And there have been lots of unique things that people who design album covers have done where there's actually, like, stickers you can pull off, or it's actually, like, there's one album, it's by a band called the Small Faces, I think it's the album's called Ogden Nut Gone Bran, because it's actually comes in a tin can that's supposed to be fashioned to look like a fictional product called Ogden Nut Gone Bran, and it's like a tin can, like you know... I don't know what Ogden Nut Gone Bran is.
I don't think I want to know what that is.
But so Brain Salad Surgery is one of those albums where sort of it's not your typical album where you just unfold it and pull it out. There's flaps, and then you have to, like, slide it out of a thing.
Very interactive.
This is really not good radio. This is not good for me to describe something that's physical and visual in an audio
setting.
Well,
of course, they can see it right now. Right?
But,
just close your eyes.
Go find
three.
Yourself a copy of Brain Salad Surgery.
In fact,
and
you could probably go to Google, and they probably have a picture of the packaging.
Yeah, and you'll see what I'm talking about. But there's other albums that do this too. Styx actually has a lot of albums that are sort of untraditional in the packaging, in that they have the flaps or they open vertically instead of horizontally. Getting off topic here.
A little bit.
It's also a great album. Number one is, for me, going to have to be In the Court of the Crimson King by King Crimson, which also, again, is another album that sort of can be credited with starting an entire genre of music. It basically created progressive rock. But this album, it's just a picture of a man screaming. It's a close-up on his face. Again, another well-known image. You might have seen it and not even realized what that was from. But it doesn't have the name of the album, it doesn't have the artist anywhere on the cover, except for, like, you know, on the side, on the spine of it. But otherwise, that there's no text, it's just this man, wide mouth screaming, and it's really, it kind of sticks with you. It's kind of off-putting.
Pink Floyd's The Wall.
What?
Is this Pink Floyd's The Wall?
No, this is King Crimson In the Court of the Crimson King.
Very similar, though.
The wall is just a straight white.
Well, they had the imagery like that in the background. Movie,
yeah.
Not the actual cover.
Yeah, the movie. That's what I was trying to refer to.
Yeah,
The
movie. Now, and they probably got that from that because
they might have
that album. It's probably came out that what was it 80, 81, right?
1969.
Oh well, then
yeah.
I'm way off. The Wall didn't come out to like 83.
Right, but it's a famous album cover. I mean, it's not just me saying this. It's on Rolling Stone's. It's like number 10 on Rolling Stone's top 100 greatest album covers.
Well, I mean, this is Rolling Stone. Rolling Stone thinks Bob Dylan is the greatest rock artist of all time.
Well, yeah, there's some issues with that. But the point is, I mean, most of these are on Rolling Stone's
list.
Well, I mean,
don't get me wrong. I like Bob Dylan, but I mean, greatest rock artist of all time? No.
But,
anyway, but that's another story for another day.
It's sort of weird how uncanny this picture is, even though it's kind of simple. So those are my top five album covers. A few honorable mentions. One would be Days of Future Past by the Moody Blues. Just this kind of odd piece of abstract art that I obviously can't describe. Number two, Traffic album, The Low Spark of High-Heeled Boys. This album is unique for the way that they sort of basically used optical illusions to make it look like it's three-dimensional. It looks like a cube. If you're looking at it straight on, it looks like a cube.
I have one.
Yes?
Jimi Hendrix, Axis of Love.
I actually can't picture that one off the top of my head, because I don't think I'm...
It's very heavily influenced by Indian art.
Okay.
It has Jimi Hendrix sort of positioned as like a Hindu sun god, and it's quite a gripping album cover.
Oh yeah, Jimi Hendrix has some pretty cool album covers too. A lot of psychedelic rock has. I mean, Cream, Disraeli Gears. That's a pretty famous one.
That's a good one.
Another, a few more honorable mentions. Any album by Roxy Music. Now, Roxy Music, they're not like crazy mind-blowing pieces of art. You'll notice that I didn't choose any album covers that were photographs, because there are a lot of famous album covers that are just photographs of the artist, like Bruce Springsteen on Born to Run, Patti Smith on Horses. It's just a picture of the artist.
Well, and actually, that's kind of why I was, when you mentioned Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, I was like, well, really? You want to pick that one? Because that really is just...
Well, that's way more than just pictures of the artist.
I don't know, dude. Like, really, go back and look at it. It's really
Abbey Road is just pictures of the artist, but it's also still one of the most iconic
I don't know,
covers.
Man. Go back. I'm just saying, go back and look at it. That's just one giant photograph. I mean...
Well, but it's lots and lots of...
Well, I understand that. But right. It's just composed of photographs.
But yeah, point is, I didn't choose albums that were just, you know, photographs, but Roxy Music... all the album covers are photographs of really hot ladies in crazy costumes, but just the photography is so well composed, and just sort of the setting, really cool. The one in particular that I actually own is called Siren, and it's like this woman is like a mermaid, and she's sort of like posed sort of seductively like underwater, but like almost kind of in an aggressive way.
Mm-hmm.
And so any album by Roxy Music has really cool.
Sweet.
Styx, as I mentioned, has a lot of cool album covers, particularly Pieces of Eight. And finally, Jethro Tull does as well. Thick as a Brick is also a really cool album cover. In that Jethro Tull does really creative things with their albums. This is another thing I was talking about, vinyl, in that Thick as a Brick is actually made to look like a newspaper. So, and it actually comes with like a newspaper in it that you can read that has these... You know, and a passion play actually has like a fake program from a play inside the album. So
it's awesome.
Yeah, this is. I love going to a record store and just seeing it, just going through the store, going through the stacks, and just looking at these pieces of art. It's art. Like it's just there in stacks and stacks and stacks of it, and you just don't get the same impression looking at a CD, or God forbid, you know, a little thumbnail on your computer.
Mm.
So. I was going to do a review of an album this week, but I'm already over time for this segment. I just want to say I picked up Fleet Foxes, their first album, on vinyl. It also came packaged with their Sun Giant EP, and I became obsessed with this album. I mean, like, I've just been playing it nonstop, and the songs have been getting stuck in my head. It's very, like, it's indie rock, but it's very folksy.
I'm pretty sure it'll be stuck in my head next week.
Yeah, that song that you played for us, which I think you're going to play during the musical break.
I am.
It's very infectious.
Yes. Very. I apologize in advance, everyone, because I'm going to get this stuck in your head. I can almost guarantee it.
If you hate songs getting stuck in your head...
You just fast forward.
But you won't mind, though, because it's such a gorgeous song.
It's so good.
It's not an annoying song.
It is.
Song.
So pretty.
But yes, it will get stuck in your head.
All people should know.
I'm cursing you right now. I'm just going to go as a... I'm cursing you with this song in your head, and you probably won't mind that much.
Hopefully not.
But yeah, just the vocal harmonies are really intricate. If you like, you know, stuff like Paul Simon, particularly on Graceland, where they do a lot of cool stuff like that, or a band that's not really similar in sound, but in the way they... do, you know, harmonizing, is TV on the Radio.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, Fleet Foxes, I dare you to put on a Fleet Foxes album and manage to have a bad day, because it's just, like, such upbeat, uplifting, positive music. So,
but not in that sickly saccharine.
Right,
way.
It's not like sweet. It's but it's just positive. It has positive energy. So, I'm gonna, you know, we're gonna take a little musical break, and I'm gonna play "White Winter Hymnal" by Fleet Foxes off of
shit in.
All right.
The album of the same name. "White Winter Hymnal" by Fleet Foxes, and when you find yourself lying awake at 2 in the morning and still humming that song, you can thank me.
Yeah, I think they'll definitely thank you.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to kick it over to you now, Colin.
Okay, well, usually what I do is I like to review my film, I like to review the film first, but in this case, I want to review the top, I want to do top 10 first.
Ooh.
So we're going to do our top 10, and this week's top 10 is a very special top 10. Hi, it's time for movies, top 10! Alright, this week's top 10 is the top 10 most underappreciated films. Now, mind you, this list is based strictly on my opinion, so if you have any comments, send it to bullygoingnowhere@podomatic.com. Otherwise, don't bitch.
Tweet, 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 tweet.
Or Twitter it, I don't give a shit. Okay,
yeah.
Bring up the
Always
list.
Feel free to bitch, just do it online.
Because you can bitch on Twitter.
Yeah, you can bitch on Twitter, you can...
And then get fired
whatever,
from your Affleck job.
Whatever, yeah, I was gonna
say. I don't know where else you would bitch, unless you were gonna, like, call us up on our personal phones to bitch.
Yeah, well, I mean, if they call us up and bitch on the telephone, they can't level up their internet penis.
Well, if they do that, I will do my...
If you were my son, I'd step.
If someone genuinely calls in to bitch, I will do my utmost best to try and record that phone call and play it on the air.
Yeah.
Don't let your jackasses drive drunk.
On the internet air.
Oh, too soon for that.
I quoted Roger Ebert on that.
Oh, Roger Ebert just put his foot in his mouth with that one.
Well, it's true. That's all. And you try to argue against him. Well, you like driving drunk?
Well, he didn't even really apologize. That's the thing. He sort of like was like, all right, I acknowledge that what I said was, you know, kind of mean, but I still don't take it back. He didn't actually take it back.
You know what Roger Ebert likes? Movies.
He does. So do we. Let's get on with it.
All right. Bring me the list. Give me the list, damn you.
Yeah, here's the list.
Thank
the list.
You.
There you go.
All right. Oh. Number 10 is The Terminal.
So unprofessional.
Yeah. The Tom Hanks film, based on a true story. This actually is Tom Hanks is basically trapped in a New York International Airport due to the fact that his country's government has fallen into civil war while he was in flight, so his passport was technically invalid, so he couldn't leave the airport or leave the country.
He fell through a crack.
He basically fell into the crack of international law, basically.
So, two things about this. Great acting, great direction by Steven Spielberg, and the soundtrack is done by John Williams, which is unlike
his
previous works.
No
yes.
way.
Yes,
yep.
It's true.
It's true.
I love John Williams.
Yeah. Who doesn't love John Williams?
Assholes.
Well, that's true. All right, next up, we have Unbreakable. This is M. Night Shyamalan after Sixth Sense, when he was still technically considered a decent actor, but before Lady in the Water, where things
say,
went to hell.
We'll say for a namesake, pre-Village. So yeah. that
pre-Village.
Should give you an idea.
Basically, yeah. Before M. Night Shyamalan became a punchline to a very tragic joke.
Like the Aristocrats.
Yeah.
What about Ong?
We're not even going to go into that.
Okay.
All right, next up, Snatch. This is a Guy Ritchie film that was released after Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. One of those Cockney crime films. It was definitely kind of snubbed by, you know, film... kind of snubbed by theaters, but honestly...
I feel like all
I think one of
Guy
the
Ritchie.
Better... I think probably one of the better films of that whole... Well, pretty much of Guy Ritchie's career at this point.
I think all his films are kind of underappreciated, but I mean, Snatch
was definitely one
really
of those gems.
Top-notch, you know, actors in it.
Yeah, I had Benicio Del Toro, Jason Statham,
Brad Pitt,
and
probably
Jones.
My favorite Brad Pitt role ever.
Yeah.
Always nice, you've always seen me now, right?
Yeah, I know, you could understand a fucking word he was saying.
I'm sure, dude, it's a good movie.
Alright, but number 7, Super Troopers, Broken Lizard's first outing, was actually probably one of their better films. I mean, there's really only 3 that they have, but whereas Beer Fest
was actually a better film. Was
well,
funnier,
Beer Fest
I would say,
was,
but...
Beer Fest, it's a matter of opinion. I mean, Beer Fest was a very good movie, but I have to admit, if you asked me which one I'd rather watch, Beer Fest or Super Troopers, I'd go with Super Troopers, basically.
At this point, I'd go with Super Troopers just because I've watched Beer Fest so many times, but before that came out, I didn't think anything could top Super Troopers. Like, it's going to be really hard for them to top Super Troopers with this, and in my mind, they did, but I mean, I can't count how many parties I've watched Super Troopers
yeah.
in. It's a great film for parties.
Well, number 6, Dark City. If you're a nerd and you've been alive in the last 20 years, you know Dark City.
You better know Dark City.
Yeah, you know Dark City. If you haven't seen Dark City, go to Netflix and pull it up on your Insta queue or rent it. I don't care. Just go see it.
Yeah.
If I explain anything, it's
Dark City. Okay.
It came out 1 year before The Matrix, and it actually has very similar themes and style.
But
to
actually,
the Matrix,
in my opinion,
but no one
it's,
saw it.
Let's be honest here. In my opinion, I think it's honestly on par with or better than The Matrix, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I love The Matrix, but I also love Dark City.
Should we see the director's cut or the regular version?
Director's cut.
I mean, always go with the director's cut as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
Next up, Shaun of the Dead. I mean, also, if you're a fan of horror films and...
Or comedies,
I mean, then you know Shaun of the Dead. But this is something that a lot of people don't realize. I mean, anybody you know, like from our generation would be like, oh, yeah, Shaun of the Dead, I've seen that hundreds of times.
Yeah, like everyone knows
about
Shaun of the Dead.
But a lot of people don't realize is that when Shaun of the Dead first came out in the U.S., it was pretty much snubbed at theaters. It had a limited release. It probably didn't do well in U.S. sales. I mean, you probably got, you know, big areas like, you know, Austin, Atlanta, New York. I mean, the international markets, those probably got more viewings than us.
Yeah, and I mean it's easy to forget, you know, when you can, in the day and age when you can get everything on DVD and DVD sales are really where the most money's made, that the theatrical releases still matter and can still make and break a movie.
But good news is for us, it actually didn't make or break this production, because even though it didn't do too well in the theater, Shaun of the Dead is still resoundingly one of the better DVD releases.
Oh, yeah.
And very reminiscent of Dawn of the Dead. And,
yes.
And it takes that and finds a new comedy.
Yeah. Yes.
And also great special features on it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just, it's a great movie.
Lucky for us, it also brought to us the pairing of Nick Frost and Simon Pegg, who have subsequently gone on to do... Hot Fuzz, and we'll be doing The World's End, I believe, next year?
Yeah.
I believe that's the end of the Ice Cream trilogy.
Right, and also, if not for Shaun of the Dead, you know, Edgar Wright wouldn't have gotten to make Hot Fuzz, and then would not have gotten to make Scott Pilgrim.
Yes.
Which is also awesome.
Which is also...
Which would be a tragedy if that
If you listen to my last podcast, you know full well that... Scott Pilgrim sits at the number one spot in my top 10 comic book adaptations.
Yeah.
If you have, if you don't know that, go back and listen to that podcast right now. We'll wait.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now you're back. We're number four, Mallrats. This is probably... This is one of the arguable positions on this. I mean, my opinion, it should... This should be one of the more popular Kevin Smith films, but honestly, most people dislike this film, and I honestly don't know why.
Yeah, most, like, diehard Kevin Smith films dislike Mallrats.
Yeah, most diehard Kevin Smith fans do not like this film, and it's because, like Justin said previously, a theatrical release can make or break a movie. And this is true. This was a $6 million budget film.
It says people are so impressed by Clerks.
Right, yeah, it's also a tough act to follow.
Yeah, I mean, you had to follow Clerks. I mean, but honestly, I've seen all of Kevin Smith's films. All the relevant ones, at least. I mean, I've seen Clerks, I've seen Mallrats, I've seen Chasing Amy, I've seen Dogma, I've seen Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, I've seen Clerks 2.
So I'm not going to see Cop Out.
I've seen the relevant ones.
I don't think anyone's going to make it.
Like I said,
Cop Out.
Well, that's why I said I've seen the relevant Kevin Smith films. But I'm gonna say this, and in all honesty, I think Mallrats is the superior Kevin Smith film. I like Clerks. I like Clerks 2. I like Dogma. I like Chasing Amy. I like all those films. But I think Kevin Smith put more of himself into Mallrats because he was aiming it towards people like him. He was aiming it to comic book nerds.
Yeah. And also, it's not as serious as the other ones. It's just, it's an entertaining movie. It's just fun to watch.
Yeah. All right, number three. Fanboys. If you're a Star Wars nerd.
Yes.
If you're a nerd and you haven't seen this movie, you might want to reconsider calling yourself a nerd.
Because this movie is definitely a movie that if you haven't seen it, you need to go see it.
I'm an ultimate Star Wars fan. As soon as Colin here introduced me to this film, it literally completed me. Like it was a gap missing in my life from the Star Warsdom. And I read the books.
I read the Timothy Zahn novels. I read expanded universe novels.
Yeah.
That's
expanded
how big
universe novels
are.
We really know what Kashyyyk is. And knowing crap like that, they reference it throughout this movie. If you really love Star Wars,
encyclopedias.
See this. I can't recommend this movie highly enough. Yeah. And plus, Seth Rogen, the finest acting he has, is in this film.
Well, I mean, let's be honest here. All right, let's go through this. I mean, first of all, the reason why this movie isn't so well known is because of the fact that in the middle of it, I mean, it was supposed to be released in 2005.
Oh, yeah. So many problems with that production.
It didn't get released until 2007. The producers thought that the film... let me give you a spoiler alert here. If you don't want to know this, then... If you haven't seen it and you don't want to know the ending here, pause it for about 2.5 minutes while I go into my dissertation here. But...
will this lecture be available on audio cassette?
in the film, one of the characters has contracted cancer and is slowly dying. And so basically the point of the movie is they're going to steal episode one so that he can see it before he kicks it. Well, the producers, when the film was finished, felt that that subject matter was so depressing that they told the director, you have to go back and you have to re-edit this. You have to come up with a different ending. This is far too depressing. No one's going to want to watch this.
Even though it was by far the superior ending.
Yes. So they went back, reshot it, showed it to a test audience. The test audience hated it. Hated it.
Yeah.
And so finally, I don't know if it was Miramax or the Weinberg Company, one of the two companies, I don't remember which one it was that actually distributed
Probably
it.
Probably Miramax.
I think it was the Weinberg Company, actually. But, they basically went back and re-released it with the original ending. And, like Justin said, the original ending is the far superior of the two endings. And it is, I mean, even though it's the more depressing subject matter, where the character who did get cancer does end up dying. Once again, spoiler alert, I warned you. But Fanboys has great... Great cameos. It has Shooter McGavin,
Rush's variety,
and also it does give tribute to Rush fucking...
Yes.
Who doesn't love Rush? Rush is variety, bitch.
Which is a quote from there that you'll find very amusing.
Yes, okay. But, alright, enough of that. Let's move on to the next one. Number two, Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah.
This is one of those gems from the 1980s.
Yeah, and we did talk about Big Trouble in Little China a bit, you know, when we were talking about, I think when we were talking about shocking moments. We've probably talked about Big Trouble in Little China on every single podcast. We'll just keep that a tradition.
Okay.
And to make this more funny, watch Soldier, then watch this movie.
Yes. Yeah, if you're gonna... to show you the gamut of Kurt Russell's acting, watch those two movies. Watch Soldier first, and then watch Big Trouble in Little China.
And then watch Sky High.
Oh, God.
Or Sky High.
Or Miracle.
He's the dad in Sky High.
He's the dad in Sky High. Or Miracle, either one.
Yeah.
I was about to say Starman, but I confused with Jeff Bridges.
No, that's Jeff Bridges. Alright, but...
Digital Jazz Man.
Let's be honest here. Okay, the Big Trouble in Little China was a great movie because the movie itself is just so fucking ridiculous.
It really is.
See, the problem with that movie is the movie was originally supposed to be set in 1880.
Yes.
In Chinatown. Yeah. Okay, but they felt that the Western setting didn't really... basically create an effective enough character for the... background for the character. So they actually moved it from San Francisco in the 1880s to San Francisco in the 1980s. Which, I mean... pretty good, but then you have to realize the incision of the fantasy element sort of is dimmed by the fact that you set it in the present day and not in the past.
Yeah.
But I will give you... I will give the filmmakers credit. James Wong... Yeah. Is, quite frankly, that is his best acting role.
And he's had some pretty great roles.
Yes. Like, he was the teacher in Balls of Fury, but Lo Pan, oh man, you can't get better than that.
Although, having seen the movie as it is, I just, like, can't imagine Jack Burton as a cowboy. Like, he just, as a truck driver, it's so perfect. Like,
yeah.
I think it's actually better.
Well, see, the thing is, the Jack Burton character was supposed to be sort of Duke-esque.
Right.
Which you can sort of pick up on that, you know, Kurt Russell is still trying to do that sort of John Wayne
impression. Yeah, he was occasionally trying to go into his John Wayne drawl.
Which, honestly, it didn't detract, but, I mean, you could tell when he was doing it. You were like, stop it. Just, no.
I mean, John Wayne's a pretty easy impression to do, so...
This movie made me want to play Mortal Kombat.
Really?
That, too.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
With the hats and electricity.
By the way, okay, I'm gonna say this. Some of the funniest death scenes you will ever see in any movie ever in this movie. It's fucking ridiculous. Go see it if you can.
Yeah.
Just rent it on DVD, just go see it. And finally, my number one underrated film of all time is actually, believe it or not, going to be the film I'm actually going to review, because originally we were supposed to go see Green Lantern, but we couldn't be bothered. So I went back, I actually reviewed a movie that I saw originally in 1994 when I was about 8 years old. The film is called PCU.
Ta-da!
And PCU is good for a couple of different reasons, and I guess now we're going to go into the review process here, but PCU is funny because it's... And I hate to have to compare it to another film because that just sort of cheapens it, but Animal House, it's basically what Animal House was to the 70s, PCU is to the 90s.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's what it is. It's just an updated version of Animal House. It's just Animal House in the
90s. I mean, different settings, different characters.
Different settings, different... I mean, it's not about fraternities.
But it
And then it, you know, sort of PCU, it's the 90s.
Yeah.
Get it?
It's... politically correct.
It makes sense.
But it's a great film for so many reasons. One, Jeremy Piven is the the leader, Tim Matheson in Animal House.
Yeah.
Jeremy Piven is the leader of this group, this motley group of college students.
The problem with that is that even
term.
You know, even 15, 16 years ago, Jeremy Piven still looked way too old to be on a college campus. Like, it's ridiculous. He looks, you know, I don't even know how old he is now, but he looked 40, like, in that movie, and he's running around pretending to be a college student.
Well, actually, and he does say, I think one of the more memorable lines in that movie was when he actually mentioned how long he had actually been in school for.
Right.
Was I believe
7 years.
They were basically drumming. There was a protest outside of their dorm hall. And they were basically banging on bongos. He's like, oh, Deadly Zulu drum protest. I haven't seen one of those since my third sophomore year.
Right.
There's one movie that I think kind of underappreciated PCU even more. It's a more recent movie that that lead actor did was The Goods.
See, I didn't see that, but I thought it looked funny.
I've seen parts of The Goods, and what I've seen, I've liked. Jeremy Piven is just a solid actor.
I love
all
Jeremy Piven. I love Entourage. I love Smokin' Aces.
The thing is, people that watching that movie, watching The Goods, if you didn't understand PCU, you probably couldn't understand that particular.
Yeah, if you didn't understand The Goods, then you won't understand PCU. But I'm still gonna say go see it because it's. Why? Well, not only is Jeremy Piven good, you also have a good undercast. I mean, you got David Spade.
Yes.
David Spade playing the uptight Reaganite, which is pretty funny.
The classic David Spade role.
You also have what's his name? The guy, John Favreau, the guy who directed Iron Man,
right?
And yeah. Cowboys and Aliens.
Oh, soon to be released.
Is he soon to be released
into theaters, which I will be having an event on that I will plug later.
Okay.
Excellent.
Suspense.
But there was those, I mean, all those actors are actually quite good in this film. Rasta Cosby.
Yep.
All right, I'm giving Justin credit because we were all like, it's a Ross because Colin's like, it's a Rossi and Bill Cosby. He just goes, Rasta Cosby.
Probably.
I lost my shit.
Simple, effective, to the point.
To the point. It was good. All right, now.
Well, I think we're forgetting someone very important, Colin.
No, I'm not forgetting. I was actually getting to him.
Oh, okay.
George Clinton.
Well, you still forgot someone.
Who did I forget?
The Busey. The little Busey.
Jake Busey.
Not the Busey.
All right. Jake Busey does make an appearance in this.
Without his treasured violin.
Yeah, yeah. Jake Busey does make an appearance in this as the lead pothead.
Marvelous.
And his teeth are still perfect as ever. I don't know what it is about the Busey family, dude. They have genetically perfect teeth.
I think basically what it is, they traded their sanity for perfect teeth.
They traded their endocrine systems.
I'll suck out your endocrine system. All right. Not only that, but and then I was getting George Clinton and the Parliament Funkadelic perform in the final in the third act of this film, and it is quite frankly fucking awesome.
It is worth the price of admission.
I mean, nowadays you can find this movie in a bargain bin for $5.
So yes, it is worth the price.
Far worth the price of admission. Basically, get this movie. I mean, even if you're not a huge fan of any of these actors, just go see this movie because it's hilarious.
It's really interesting that both of us, our first exposure to George Clinton was. It were in movies.
Good Burger and then this film.
Mine, Undercover Brother. In the beginning, put a ball to bit.
Also an excellent movie. That would be a good blast for the past one sometime to do a review of Undercover Brother because I love that movie.
Yeah, that is a good movie,
but,
I'll admit.
I mean, just George Clinton is so awesome. Both movies, it's the highlight.
Yeah, I will say this. If I know we are definitely going to be looking into it, but I would say next time George Clinton performs in the Baltimore area, we are so going to that shit.
Oh, yeah, we are.
Hell yeah.
I mean, we might be the only white boys in that place, but I don't give a shit. I would risk getting stabbed to go see that shit.
I'll risk it for the funk.
Yeah.
For the funk.
Because we want the funk.
Gotta have that funk.
We needs the funk.
Gotta have that funk.
Pure and uncut.
Yep. Well, that ends my review, which means we've come to the end of the program.
Boy. It's been a wild ride, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has.
Wild, repetitive ride.
Well, Sean, it was great to have you, as always. In fact,
thank you.
It's safe to say you'll probably be making fairly regular appearances from now on. Like,
I think I shall.
I think what we're saying is we've asked Sean to come on as the third host to Boldly Going Nowhere.
Yes. Because we want it in the situation to where if we're at a live sports event and we need to have our shirts off and have it something painted, there's three letters, and I have to be the nowhere.
Exactly. Exactly. That is the only reason we've asked Sean to help. All of this has been grooming him. We've been grooming him to take off his shirt and paint a letter on it.
And join you in...
How else will we spell out win without the I?
Right.
Yeah. The only thing is, though,
just pull that
now that you're not going to be considered a guest, you're going to have to pick up after yourself.
Oh,
I know, it seems harsh, but it's the rule.
You're no longer a guest in this house. That means you have to pull your weight.
I guess I'll pick up my shavings.
So you were saying something about you had an event to announce.
We were speaking about Jon Favreau, which does Cowboys and Aliens, starring... Daniel Craig, also starring Harrison Ford, Cowboys, and Aliens. Why not see this? We're going to see it at the Regal Cinemas.
Westview
13. On July 29th. That is a Friday. Mm. And we're going to sit there and we're going to watch the movie. Then afterward, we're going to have a podcast. And I'll have a guest mic open. Anyone can come in and put their two cents of what they thought about the movie.
You know, in fact, why don't we go ahead and just announce that now? Boldly Going Nowhere live episode Friday the 29th. Are we gonna have a co-hosting with
joint episode?
No, conjoint. How about this? We'll have conjoined podcasts since I'm obviously the only
the more political term than saying Siamese podcasts.
Siamese podcasts.
We're not Siamese.
China
American.
Asian American is the preferred nomenclature.
Also, dude.
Oh, wow. Tangent. Just popped into my head. The Tron. The newer Tron. I thought here's a title for Tron. The Big Lebowski 2 Electric Boogaloo.
Yeah.
That is the title of the Neutron.
Yep, there you go.
Digital. At one point he says, digital jazz, man.
Digital jazz, man.
What?
You're really harshing my zen.
I mean, you're really messing with my zen thing, man. God damn it. Could you at least try to emote Jeff Bridges?
It was one white Russian for a Coen Brothers movie. Yeah. Anyway, so join us then on the July 29th. It'll be awesome. I mean, Cowboys and Aliens, like you ever thought in your mind, like mixing those two together, that's awesome.
I mean, plus
it's a great comic book. And that should be based off a graphic novel, so you can compare that.
Let's put it this way. Would you, the theoretical listener, would you be able to sleep at night if you knew that a movie called Cowboys and Aliens existed and you didn't go see it?
Starring Daniel Craig and Harrison Ford?
How could you live with yourself?
I don't think you could.
I think as soon as you listen to our words, if you listen to this podcast, you will be there. I'm counting on you. I'm counting on you being there.
We're counting on you, America.
So what?
Don't let us down.
I live in Los Angeles. You know what? Okay.
Yeah. Number one? Number one? I don't care.
Okay.
Number two? How did you find out about this podcast?
Yeah.
I mean, that's cool.
Why aren't you telling your friends?
Tell your friends, seriously.
Yeah. And while you're at it, plug BS Reviews Podcast and tweet us up. Follow us at BS Reviews. Also follow the BNG Podcast. What? BGN?
BGN.
Like Lex Dexia.
Once again, like I said, you're no longer a guest.
Lex Dexia.
You have to know the name of the podcast.
Yeah, you gotta know the name of the podcast,
man.
Dude.
You're no
Boldly
longer,
Going Nowhere just, Podcast.
Yeah, you can't just skate through this shit. I know.
I don't know what kind of show you're running over at BS Reviews, but we take our shit seriously here, son.
We also no longer under any obligation to plug your podcast. We don't have to plug your shitty podcast anymore. It's not shitty.
No, it's not shitty.
It's not shitty at all. I'm just saying we don't have to plug it because you're no longer a guest.
Yeah, you can plug it as much.
That's
as you
why
want.
I took the reins.
Okay.
I took the plugging reins of the BS Reviews podcast.
Oh, good.
And I took it, and everything's fine there. So anyway, just check that out. Listen to both of us. I think some good things are to come.
Excellent. So remember, folks, hot double podcasting action on the 29th of July.
Ooh, two podcasts, one show.
Kinky.
All right. Well, before this gets into some dirty jokes, until next time, I'm Justin Eisenstadt.
I'm Colin Kakamas.
And I'm Sean Holmes.
And we are boldly going nowhere.
Outro.
Boldly Going Nowhere is a Los Tres Monos production.
No servers were hacked in the making of this.
John Connor, it is time to die in the battle.